Pride lands on the beaches of Venice, California, and Redefining Spouse sets the stage for Canadian equality. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending August 20th, 2016. The government of Uganda, led by its obsessively homophobic ethics minister, Simon Lokoto, is promising that it will continue to suppress the country's sexual and gender minorities. Lokoto quit the Roman Catholic priesthood in 2011 to become the government's Minister of Ethics and Integrity. He bragged during an interview this week with the notoriously anti-queer tabloid Red Pepper about the August 4th police raid on Kampala's Mr. and Miss Pride pageant, calling the participants shameless idiots who were planning to sin. He rejected what he said were Western demands that Uganda trade financial aid for the acceptance of homosexuality. They can keep their monies, he said. Africans lived before the white man came here. God will provide. Visiting evangelicals from the U.S., peddling a religious cure for homosexuality in the past decade, fueled the already hostile environment for LGBT people in the East African country to a fever pitch. Lokoto, described by the Red Pepper as an amiable man of God, said that, despite his country's crushing poverty, the government would be purchasing machines manufactured in South Korea that will detect homos in social media messaging. He went on to claim that, "The homos have been sending me messages threatening my life. Most of them even say they want to rape me," he said. "But I don't fear anything."
In happier news for LGBT people, a first-ever Pride March in the Ukrainian city of Odessa was held on August 13th. About 100 people came together along Primorsky Boulevard following a streetwide rainbow banner, protected by some 700 officers of the National Police. There were no major disruptions by far-right nationalists who had threatened violence. Authorities in Ukraine's third-largest city had first banned the march altogether, but relented as long as it stayed away from Shevchenko Park, named for one of Ukraine's most beloved writers. Gia Lortkipanidze, police chief of the Odessa region, was on hand in person to ensure that the event stayed nonviolent. About 20 anti-queer protesters were arrested for trying to breach the parade lines, but no injuries were reported. The Pride organizers hailed the successful march on their official Facebook page, writing that, "Now the whole world sees that Odessa is really an open and safe city in which there is a place for all." On June 12th, about 6,000 police officers guarded an estimated 1,000 participants in a march for equality in Kiev. There were no significant disruptions there either, in contrast to verbal and physical attacks on Pride marchers in the Ukrainian capital in previous years. Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, called the peaceful Odessa Pride proof that Ukraine is changing.
But in a legal setback for LGBT people in the United States this week, a district court ruling supported the firing of a transgender worker by a funeral home in a Detroit, Michigan area suburb. Amy Stevens had worked at the R.G. and G.R. Harris Funeral Home as a funeral director and embalmer since 2007. She informed her employer in 2013 that she would be transitioning and planned to wear clothing at work appropriate to her new gender identity. She was fired 2 weeks later for what she was proposing to do. Stevens was supported in her claim by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The funeral home director testified that he would be violating God's commands if he allowed Stevens to present as female at work. District Court Judge Sean Cox decided that the business was entitled to discriminate under provisions of the Religious Freedom Exemption Act because not doing so would impose a substantial burden on its ability to conduct business in accordance with its sincerely held religious beliefs. Cox's August 18th ruling ran against the tide of recent federal court decisions that U.S. civil rights laws banning bias based on sex also protect transgender people from discrimination.
But the decision seems to be consistent with a 2014 U.S. Supreme Court ruling involving Hobby Lobby's denial of contraception to its employees under the company's health care plan. The High Court allowed it and other closely held-for-profit companies to be considered as individuals under the Religious Freedom Exemption Act, and therefore be permitted to cite religious beliefs for denying the contraception benefit to its workers. Jillian Weiss of the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund joined a chorus of LGBT rights groups condemning this week's district court ruling. "We cannot go back to the days," she said, "in which people could be forced to conform to employers' gender stereotypes in order to keep their jobs." The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission tweeted that it was disappointed with the decision and is reviewing next steps.
In other news, Tony Perkins, who leads the infamously anti-queer Family Research Council, found out this week that karma can be a bitch. He's among a number of far-right Christian conservative leaders who've claimed that God uses hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes, and lethal diseases to punish people for sinning, especially gay people. He specifically called recent hurricanes a sign of God's wrath for the legalization of gay marriage. Perkins was among the thousands of people made homeless this week by record rainfall of what he called near-biblical proportions in and around Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He phoned into his own Family Research Council radio show to say that he and his family were forced to escape their flooded home in a canoe. But never one to miss trying to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, Perkins said that the natural disaster offered a chance for Christians to rejoice that God considers them worthy of suffering for his sake. The flooding has caused the deaths of at least 13 people and left more than 40,000 people homeless.
But help in many forms is on the way. The National Basketball Association announced last month that it was pulling its 2017 All-Star Game out of Charlotte because of North Carolina's onerous law, known as HB2. It denies local governments the right to enact LGBT anti-bias protections and requires trans people to use the bathrooms that match the gender on their birth certificates. The NBA confirmed on August 19th that the new location of the 2017 All-Star Game would be New Orleans. Despite the devastating flooding nearby, the Crescent City has remained relatively dry. The All-Star Game will be an economic boon to the state. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards, a Democrat, issued an executive order when he took office in January banning anti-LGBT bias in state employment and services, and rescinding an order by his predecessor, Republican Bobby Jindal, which allowed such discrimination. Even though Louisiana doesn't have statewide anti-bias protections for LGBT people, neither have lawmakers considered a law similar to North Carolina's HB2. Edwards pitched the NBA on holding the 2017 All-Star Game in New Orleans last month because of what he called his state's commitment to diversity and equality. "Even in the midst of a historic crisis," he said in a celebratory statement, "I am excited that the NBA has recognized how great the city of New Orleans and the state of Louisiana are."
And finally, Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump made an unusual teleprompted speech about terrorism this week, as opposed to his usual freewheeling off-the-cuff comments. He called for the extreme vetting of immigrants, suggesting that they pass an ideological test before being allowed into the country. His advisors have told reporters that such a test might include support for religious pluralism, women's rights, and even LGBT rights. But out lesbian CNN News commentator Sally Cohn said after the speech that Trump's promises don't pass the smell test.
"We cannot let the hateful ideology of radical Islam, its oppression of women, gays, children, and non-believers be allowed to reside or spread within our own countries."
"If we're going to start doing an ideological test and not allow into this country people who don't support gender equality and LGBT rights, then, I don't know, how about the entire Republican Party platform committee that voted to say that it should be okay to send your kids to anti-gay, destructive, homophobic conversion therapy? Why don't we get rid of them? Just one example. I'm sorry, this whole want to use gay rights and women's rights not to actually give gay rights and women's rights to people in this country, but simply as a fig leaf to bash Muslims. Let me be clear, there are Muslims in this world, including in this country, who are far better on gay rights and women's rights than many of the people in the Republican Party."
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 20th, 2016, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Pride premieres in Venice, California, and a bad breakup becomes good news in Queer Canada later in the program. Lesbian athletes have hit it big at the 2016 Rio Olympic Games. Brazil's Rafaela Silva took gold in her judo category, and Italian swimmer Rachel Brunei won silver and came out by dedicating the win to her beloved. The much-touted first same-gender married participants Kate and Helen Richardson-Walsh's British hockey team beat the Netherlands for the gold, with Kate scoring one of the winning penalties in the final shootout. On the downside for Team LGBT, it was a heartbreaking loss for Britain's Tom Daley. Daley medaled in last week's synchronized diving competition, but shockingly sank to last place this week in the 10-meter platform diving competition. Off the playing field, NBC made up for its original mishandling of the relationship between British beach volleyballer Larissa Franca and her wife Lilaine Mastriani by airing a beautiful profile of the couple. In the ally category, U.S. gymnast Dana Oliva won two silver medals in Rio. Just after making the team, and soon after the Pulse massacre in Orlando, Leva recorded a video in support of the LGBT community.
Recently, there has been much said about trans rights and the danger people fear they may pose if they are allowed to use whatever bathroom they wish. These people, of course, are wrong. The danger comes from bigotry, not the victims of it. And it is our responsibility as non-LGBT people to help create a world where LGBT people don't need to create their own safe spaces. That is a promise I'm making, and I hope you will join me in making it.
Hello, I'm Billy Beane, Major League Baseball's Ambassador for Inclusion, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
By the end of the 90s, the Supreme Court of Canada was no longer giving governments the flexibility to recognize gay rights on their own timeline.
Still to come, more from Canada's queer decade. But first... keep moving west from Los Angeles Pride's parade route through West Hollywood, and you'll find yourself in Venice Beach, where the sunset of one tradition led to the dawn of a new one. This Way Out correspondent Matthew McLaughlin takes us to the eccentric enclave.
In response to the closing of the West Side's only gay bar, the Roosterfish, as well as in memoriam to LA City Councilman and LGBT family member Bill Rosenthal, the City of Venice held its inaugural Gay Pride celebration. Hosted by Councilman Mike Bonin, sponsors included Silicone Beach Editions, Snapchat, and Google, as well as the Irwin Hotel and local beachfront restaurant and bar, Danny's, owned by Venice resident Danny Samakow, who opened his doors to the town's LGBT community with Surf's Up Fridays.
I'm Daniel Savago, and I'm part of the Venice community.
And as owner of Danny's Venice, yes. With the Roosterfish closing, you've kind of stepped up.
Yes, actually, you know, with the Roosterfish closing, I was just going to speak about that because Bill Rosenthal said, Daniel, we need to keep a place for the community to meet. And essentially, I'll announce tonight that Danny's is going to be that place for the community. We're starting with Wednesdays and Fridays nights, doing events those nights, and then we'll go on into other nights as well.
That's fantastic. What a wonderful tribute to Bill.
Bill, our first gay, openly gay city council person. I only wish he was here tonight. He would be in his element.
I think
oh my God! Yeah. It's a thing that was a long time coming. Venice is such a community of diversity and acceptance that we should be celebrating Pride. We do celebrate Pride literally every day in Venice, but it's nice to do it this way.
Thank you so much. Have a great time tonight.
This was haphazard. I just kind of found out about it just by perusing around and doing some disco research, okay? And then I find out there's a gay pride, the first ever happening in Venice Beach.
Took a while.
Venice, California. That's so amazing to hear. I think people refuse to let go of the word grassroots, you know? I mean, you see what West Hollywood has done and taken West Hollywood to the places where it never used to be.
Yeah.
It used to belong to the people. Look what we've got. They're right now, as you look around, they're all making it their own. They don't know quite what to do yet, you know? So they're texting everybody.
However, if you look out there, organization on the dance floor is formed.
Exactly.
It's the electric boogie.
They're making it their own, and I think that is probably the one of the most amazing things that could happen right now.
It's kind of a magical moment.
Good for us.
Nice to share it with you.
A pleasure. A pleasure. Thank
you so much. Who are you and why are you here?
I am a horny and I'm here because I want to shake my
Are you excited about the first Pride in Venice?
Yes. I'm like a half stripper. I used to be a porn star, so yes.
I'm Kelvin, and I've been a local in Venice for 10 years, and this is a big deal. I don't think people in Venice know how big a deal this is to light the Venice lights, the famous Venice lights, in the colors of the gay rainbow, but it's a big deal, so I'm here to support it.
I'm LJ Carrison. I'm here to celebrate Pride Venice Beach, the first one ever, 2016.
We lost the Roosterfish recently. Do you have any favorite memories of the Roosterfish?
You know, I have lots of fond memories. I actually came out at the Roosterfish, so my memories all began there as a gay man, and I met my first boyfriend ever at the Roosterfish. So lots of fond memories.
Hi, my name is Khadija Murray, and I'm here to enjoy the beach on this awesome day and attend Pride.
It's our first Venice Pride. Would you have any high hopes for it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm really excited to see the sign go up.
Who are you and why are you here tonight?
This is Eric Brown. I'm with the Rock Club Foundation. This one goes out to all the dreamers on behalf of all of us that are still dreaming.
Right on.
I tell you, all the people out there that are still sleeping and never dreaming, wake up. It's time to dream. It's time to live your dreams. It's time to open up your eyes and look up at the sky. And bleeding with the day is blue again, and we live in the war.
The event culminated with the lighting of the Venice sign in the colors of the Pride rainbow, done by trans celebrity Gigi Gorgeous, who pulled the switch.
Hey, what's up? Yeah. Here, even in the rain, even though I did my hair. I'm so honored to be here, and I'm thrilled to be a part of this amazing ceremony. I mean, Venice Pride is the first one of all, and I mean, it's raining and we're all together, but we've been through much worse, and that's what's most important. We're standing together, and it's all about the love and support today. And I'm here with amazing Mike Bonin. I love him so much. Does anyone want me to speak or no? Should we just get to lighting the Venice sign? Yeah? Okay, let's do it.
All right, everybody, for the first ever lighting of the Venice Pride sign, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Matthew McLaughlin was on the scene at the Venice Beach, California Pride celebration for This Way Out.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
It took years of work for Canadian activists to bring about the breakthroughs for LGBT liberation they achieved from 1995 to 2005. That's the period covered in a documentary called Queer Decade, produced for CITR Vancouver, British Columbia, by veteran This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching. The first part of Queer Decade looked at the Egan versus Canada case that laid the foundation for LGBT rights in Canada. Part two recalls the expansion of the movement to include people of faith and of color, and the victories that opened the path to marriage equality. Kitching's home base in Vancouver gave her a front row seat for those stories.
I moved here in 1990 when I was 17. In 1993, I started a radio show called Queer FM on CITR. I had no idea at the time, but I was about to document one of the most phenomenal decades in the struggle for queer equality, 1995 to 2005. It was the decade we went from no constitutional human rights to full legal marriage.
Hi, I'm Tim Stevenson, currently a Vancouver City Councillor. And prior to that was an MLA and a cabinet minister in the provincial government. In 1996, when I became an MLA, we were struggling just even to change the definition of spouse, and this wasn't even to have marriage. I mean, marriage wasn't even on the radar. Ujo Dosage, myself, and now, ironically, Rachel Notley, who's now the Premier of Alberta, we were the three that took on changing the definition of spouse in British Columbia in every piece of legislation in the province. And we were successful. Rachel Notley was a young lawyer, brilliant, and she was a ministerial assistant to Ujo Dosage. The Liberal opposition at the time, they were saying, oh, this is just a smokescreen. All you want to do is open this up to marriage. And we kept saying, no, we want to make sure that the definition of spouses just changed within all of the legislature. That's a different fight. That may come down the line. But and so they were trying to stop it at that point because they saw that as opening the door. And I guess in many ways they were right. I don't think people realize even today as to the monumental decision that was, because anywhere in any piece of legislation that it referred to spouse, that legislation was changed to include gay and lesbian.
By the end of the 90s, the Supreme Court of Canada was no longer giving governments the flexibility to recognize gay rights on their own timeline. In 1998, it ordered the Alberta government to protect lesbian, gay, and bisexual people from discrimination in employment and services. Then, in 1999, it ruled that Ontario had to treat same-sex couples as spouses. The case was called M versus H. It involved a woman who was left penniless after her lesbian partner broke up with her. She tried to sue her ex for spousal support, but Ontario's Family Law Act defined a spouse as an opposite-sex partner. The M versus H decision meant that governments across Canada had to do what BC was already doing, change every law that defined a spouse as an opposite-sex partner to include same-sex partners.
So my name is MTS Poppet. I'm a coordinator of Salaam Vancouver Queer Muslim Community. It was around that time somebody told me there was a queer Muslim conference happening in New York called Al-Fatiha, which was a genesis of the global queer Muslim movement. And to me, that was really important. So I came to Vancouver and we started a chapter of Al-Fatiha in Vancouver. But you know, because Fatiha is not just the opening part of the Quran, it's also a prayer you say when people die at the cemetery. Some people thought that the name Al-Fatiha was kind of morbid. So we changed our name to Salamat, which is the root of Salam. The people and the faith communities were very welcoming. So, you know, we started doing dialogue with queer Jews and then connecting with also with indigenous communities and their spirituality. So I think that was really important because, you know, when people started coming out in the 90s, people couldn't put spirituality and faith and being queer together. It was a struggle for them. And by creating these faith communities, we were giving people an opportunity to say that, yes, we can be queer and Muslim or queer and Christian or queer and Jew. And people were reclaiming that because a lot of people had to leave their faith communities in order to come out as trans, as lesbian, gay, and so on.
My name is Mary Wu Sims, and I'm the former Chief Human Rights Commissioner for British Columbia. I think that as a community, we really grew from thinking of ourselves as predominantly white middle class movement to a seriously rainbow coalition or community. That's not to say that we don't have pockets of racism still that exist in our community, or that we don't understand necessarily the plight of people who are poor in our community. You know, there's still a work to be done, but I do think that in those years where we were struggling as a community, we needed help, and there was help that came from all segments of society.
On the next part of Heather Kitching's award-winning documentary...
The issue of who decides what you can or can't read was really the crux of the case.
As a group of people who have undergone seizures after seizures and decades of struggle against Canada Customs, we feel enormously vindicated.
The Little Sisters Bookstore Battle, when Queer Decade returns to This Way Out.
Queer Decade 1995 to 2005 was written and produced by me, Heather Kitching. Madeline Taylor engineered the interviews. Queer Decade uses music composed by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. Details are at http://creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0. The compositions are called Shades of Spring, Walking Along, Spellbound, Acid Jazz, Chipperdoodle Volume 2, EDM Detection Mode, Ether Disco, Pyro Flow, Danger Storm, Lightness Dawn, Babylon, Son of a Rocket, String Disco, Your Call, and Basement Floor. Queer Decade is a production of CITR Radio and the UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Carol Myers, John Dyer V, Matthew McLaughlin, and Heather Kitching contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. John Williams and Triumph performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this show possible. Check out the latest program information, pics of the crew, and a lot more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WOJB Hayward, Wisconsin, KUNR Reno, Nevada, 2CHR Chesnut, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit on WFPL.
Welcome back, listeners. So it is about the 3-year anniversary of the Black Lives Matter movement and the hashtag. Also, it's been about 3 years since the Trayvon Martin incident. And it's also the, 1-year anniversary of Sandra Bland's death in police custody. So we wanted to take today's episode and share with you all not only some hot topics that relate to race and things that of that nature, but also share with you all some tidbits of past episodes that have included discussions about the Black Lives Matter movement, Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, etc. And so in particular, we want to revisit two episodes, one of which featured our friend Lucy Brooks, who's the mother of several Black and biracial children, and then also Attica Scott, a former councilwoman who is now a state representative-elect. And she also visited our show in the last couple years to talk a bit about her reflections as a mother of a Black son and also as a legislator. So we're going to take a listen to some of those excerpts a little bit later on. But perhaps you all have heard about what happened in Connecticut recently. Earlier this week, it made headlines. Now, this happened back in mid-June, but it's only recently made headlines. And it's the case of a 38-year-old dining hall employee at a college there on Yale University. His name is Corey Menefee, and he worked there at the university for about 8 years, and just recently he moved to this particular part of the campus, and there was a stained glass window on campus that depicted an enslaved narrative, enslaved folk.
It was enslaved people picking cotton.
Picking cotton, yes. This was a stained glass window as part of the decor of the dining hall or this particular part of campus, and so Corey decided that he didn't like that image, and so he took a brick or a rock or took something and he busted the window depicting the enslaved folk, and he was subsequently arrested and charged with vandalism, and so this made headlines recently. And so on his part, Corey told the press, quote, "An image was brought to my attention and I destroyed that image. I probably shouldn't have, but I did. It was a disturbing image of what appeared to be two slaves, a male and a female, carrying baskets to a cotton field." So that window was inside Calhoun College, which of course was named after former Vice President John C. Calhoun, who was very much a defender of enslavement and slavery during the 19th century. Now, of course, students over the years have protested for the college's name to be changed, but that had not happened. And so Menefee was in court earlier this week to face a felony charge of criminal mischief and reckless endangerment. And so activists were there to support him. A lot of folks from the New Haven area came to say that folk have the right to not have to work in what they consider a racist environment. And so Corey really had a lot of people wrapping their arms around him. And subsequently, even Yale University itself has decided not, or rather they have encouraged the state to not press charges against Corey.
There has to be another hearing, though, because when Yale decided, okay, we won't press charges against Corey, it was after his initial hearing.
By the time it's in the state's hands, mm-hmm, as opposed to their own. So there were some activist groups there, and they said things like, one quote they have in particular says, "Yale has to decide which is more valuable, a stained glass window or the dignity and humanity of the black people who live and work at Yale." And so Yale said in a statement on Tuesday that it requested that the state's attorney not press charges and that they would not be seeking restitution for the broken window. So that request, though, was not communicated to the prosecutor until after the court hearing, as you pointed out. So there's been another hearing scheduled for July 26th, when all the charges will likely be dismissed. And that's according to a state's assistant attorney there in Connecticut. So it's important to note that after Mr. Menefee broke the window, there was a committee there at Yale who recommended that several windows related to slavery be removed and that they maybe, you know, display them in some kind of display, but that they have no place necessarily front and center in the windows on a college campus. And that's similar to what's happening here in Louisville in terms of the Confederate monument on the campus of University of Louisville. And that's been in the news lately, led by Dr. Ricky Jones at U of L and opposed by a lot of right-wing conservative folk. There's this monument paying homage to people who fought for enslavement, people who essentially were trying to commit treason. Yeah,
and people who lost, too,
but they were trying to commit treason against the United States.
Yeah, they were basically trying to break away from the United States. Most Americans understand the Civil War to be a war in which freed enslaved Africans. And yes, it did, but initially the war starts because the South wants to break away from the United States and create its own United States of America, which is treason, which was beyond audacious at the time. And the reason why the South was interested in breaking away from the rest of the United States had to do with the fact that enslavement, which was their free labor for 400 years, which made the South kings, if you will, economically, that it would destroy the South. If you got rid of enslavement, then it would destroy the South economically. And in reality, the South has never, ever been able to recover.
Yeah.
Since they lost enslavement as the main economic force and labor unit in and around Southern areas, they haven't been able to recover. It remains poor and this, then the third. But nonetheless, the Confederacy statue really is honoring the losers. I mean, that's what I think is so ironic and so funny about it, is people are always like, the Confederate flag, Confederate statues. And it's like, what? We live in the West in the United States, which is an extremely competitive nation, especially when it comes to like sports and, you know, we're winners, you're losers. But they're always parading this loser statue and loser flag. It's like, you didn't win. You didn't win. You lost. So the whole idea about it's about Southern pride, and it's like, pride in what? Losing? Not winning?
Yeah.
That's like cracks me up.
Yeah. So shout out to the folks there at Yale who clearly made the right decision. And I don't know if probably because of the public pressure, because again, this happened in June. And it just so happened that the week this made headlines, a few days later, Yale withdraws its desire to press charges. But hey, you know, this is much in the vein of the young woman there in South Carolina, Bree Newsom, who climbed the pole and took down the Confederate flag, that there has always been a place and a space for folk who choose. There's lots of ways to resist. And I always say there's lots of ways to resist. And this is just and one may disagree. Listeners, you may disagree as an individual with the notion of damaging someone's property or, you know, folk talk about looting or any kind of, you know, even sit-ins. Folk got problems with sit-ins because they're disruptive to the traffic flow. So there will always be people who think that there are better ways and less resistive or less confrontational ways to fight back. But I think there has to be a need for people who have decided that, hey, you got to break a few windows every once in a while. And so I think it's important. There's a place for it. Mm-hmm. Also, this week, Hip Hop Honors by VH1.
Yeah.
They honored some of the legendary female figures, women figures in hip hop, including Salt-N-Pepa, Lil' Kim, Queen Latifah, and Missy Elliott. And I thought it was a pretty good show. I enjoyed bits and pieces of it.
Some parts more than
others.
My favorite, you know what my favorite was?
What was your favorite?
My favorite was when Monica Tweet and Fantasia.
What did they do? Other songs about Missy. If Fantasia did, if you don't want me, then don't talk to me.
Yeah, if you want me, then don't talk to me. And okay.
Monica did So Gone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's my jam.
Okay.
And then Tweet, of course, did That was my favorite.
Yes, yes.
I love Monica's outfits.
Yeah, oh, Monica, that was cute.
And the thing I loved being reminded of is how many songs Missy has written. I mean, I guess I just didn't realize.
Well, and of course, before she was an artist, she was a producer and a songwriter. And so that's I appreciated seeing Mona Scott there, who a lot of us know from producing like Love and Hip Hop and those kind of
shows.
And
I didn't know Mona Scott discovered Missy.
She didn't necessarily discover her, but she was her first manager. Now, if Missy pointed out that the woman in the audience standing up was the woman who first signed her, but Mona was her first manager. So Missy is producing, and Mona says to her, like, yo, you have what it takes to be famous. Let me manage you. Like, when her career first starts taking off, Mona says, let me manage you. And Missy's like, I don't need a manager. I got this. And so Mona's her first manager.
Okay,
And kind of a co-creator. So,
yeah.
You know, it was cool to see the history of hip-hop
and how far
it's come and just, what 30, 40 years this is all taking place over the course of. So.
Yeah, and like I like that they were trying to assert and drive home the point that black women and black hip-hop artists that are women basically have been the architects as well of hip-hop as a movement, as a genre of music, as all those things. And so, you know, I loved that. Although, I would have liked to see MC Light. I mean, MC Light got on stage, but I would have liked to see her as one of the honorees
but
as well.
But I think someone pointed out that Light has been honored before.
Because
I think Charlamagne the God, who has the radio show, said he pointed out, someone pointed out that MC Light has been honored before.
Okay, because I remember Light as a rock.
Yeah, it was good to see a lot of, like, because, you know, we forget that there's a lot of female MCs, including, like, Lady of Rage, Rod Digga.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of ones who really
aren't. I mean, they got on stage.
Who aren't as popular.
You
know, and that was cute. The only person that was obviously missing that was Nicki Minaj. And I wonder if that was intentional. Because someone else pointed that out.
I think it was definitely intentional.
Intentional. Because I think that a lot of, you know, if you ask me, a lot of the can't takes, you know, that Missy really, you know, that's not to take anything away from those other artists. Yeah. But Missy is, Nicki is the hottest thing going right now. And I think that there might be a lot of resent. I mean, obviously, there's the beef between Kim and Nicki. But I think that there still could have been a place for Nicki Minaj in that tribute. And she probably could have tributed all those artists in an over way, you know.
Oh, I'm sure she,
because she's
so
creative.
I'm sure she would have.
Yeah.
But I do think that, you know, they did the one thing, right? They already pushed the envelope with Faith, honoring Lil' Kim.
Yeah.
Okay, knowing that they've had beef for mad years.
Yeah.
So they kind of threw the gauntlet down, threw the sword down, and were, you know, vibing with one another. But I do think for Kim's own sanity, Nicki just could not be there.
Absolutely,
I mean, Nicki could not. She could not be there. But she was a doll. I mean, I just forget how little Kim is.
And petite and adorable.
She is a petite baby doll. I mean, she and her little voice. I wish I could take all of y'all with me. I wish I could take. It's like, oh, my God, I love her.
Mm-hmm. In other news, Black Twitter's at it again. They're slaying another celebrity.
So funny.
Who has put their foot in their proverbial mouth. And it's J-Lo, America's sweetheart, J-Lo.
Okay. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay,
are
yes.
you L? No, she says, are you L? Are you L?
Oh, does she say are you L?
Because you thought she was saying, are you ready?
Yeah, I always thought that, but yeah, that's her 90s song.
For listeners
song
who
with
don't
Ja
know, yeah, with Ja Rule.
You know, are
yeah.
you L?
Yes, so
you know?
Yeah, we had a discussion. So anyway, but that's a good point. In the 90s and early 2000s, Jennifer yeah. Lopez, then known as J-Lo,
right?
Jay
from
and,
the block.
And again, she gets the name J-Lo as of her association with P. Diddy,
yes.
whom she was dating at the time.
Yeah, and even before that, she was a fly girl on A Living Color.
She was. So for much of her early career, she was very much an urban Latina. She very much was in association with black people and rap
oh,
music
yeah. and
hip-hop music.
And then especially
music.
Her derriere,
yeah.
which was the topic of conversation when she becomes a part of mainstream media.
Yeah.
The thing that even leads her into the limelight, if you will,
it's
when
how big
she's
her
with
butt was.
P. Diddy,
yeah.
is this idea that she had this quote-unquote big behind, which
yeah.
is typically associated with African-American women. So yeah. again, trying to erase the black precedent.
Yeah.
And still,
So she dates P. Diddy, and she's a fly girl, and she's J-Lo, Jenny from the Block, and then you know, as often happens, she gets that big break and she becomes America's sweetheart, whether it was, what was that, Made in Manhattan or any of those variety
yes,
of movies
Made
that
in
kind
Manhattan,
of
yes.
that kind of, you know, lead her into doing those kind of more mainstream movies. She drops J-Lo, becomes Jennifer Lopez. She starts to date, what, Ben Affleck at the time?
Yeah, Ben Affleck. And the thing that was so disgusting about her dating Ben Affleck was when she came out with that music video. I can't remember the name, but what I do remember is the image of Ben Affleck on a yacht with J-Lo, and she's her behind is showing, and he's like rubbing it like some kind of prize, conquistador. Or something
yeah.
In the video.
Who's
so again,
some
like,
black bull, yeah.
yeah. So I mean, a lot of her cachet and a lot of the things that are associated
yeah.
with her have to do with her Latinness, have to do with her close ties to blackness. And so for her to go and say,
so what
know,
she
okay,
did say
ahead.
For folks who don't know is that she was promoting essentially her new single called "Love Make the World Go Round." It's a single to benefit the victims of the shooting in Orlando at Pulse nightclub, which we've discussed. And so it's a really good cause. But she, in promoting this single, she uses a problematic hashtag. And she used the hashtag, All Lives Matter. Now, listeners, you know by now, we've discussed on the show, that All Lives Matter is a hashtag that derives in direct opposition and in direct contradiction to the notion of Black Lives Matter. So I say Black Lives Matter. The white person on the other end says, no, All Lives Matter. And that's been an ongoing conflict, and by now, people, even people who believe that they're colorblind and we should all get along, you never ever say all lives matter unless you are trying to take away from the notion that Black Lives Matter. So Jennifer Lopez does it not only once, but twice. First, she tweets it, and then she tweets it with a photo of the guy who created Hamilton. His name is Lin-Manuel Miranda. Hamilton's that really popular Broadway show, starring a lot of black and brown people. Anyway, so she does it on Twitter, and shortly thereafter, she deletes it. But she forgets that she also posted on Instagram, along with a lot of other hashtags. She hashtags All Lives Matter. And, of course, people are saying, well, did she not know? I mean, Jennifer Lopez, how could you not know that hashtag is not to be used in such a way? So, of course, she's been slayed by Black Twitter, who have reminded her, as you said, of her close proximity to hip-hop culture and black culture when it's convenient for her. They said that Jenny from the Block became Jenny from the Burbs. You know, like people are really, like, not...
Well, I think that she's been very strategic. I think that she, her whole career in the limelight, she's been very strategic as trying to erase her black past, a way to get rid of the Jenny from the Block and get rid of people remembering her with Ja Rule and P. Diddy. She's really tried her best, especially the Wayans brothers and Living Color. She's really tried her best to dissociate herself from all of that and whiten herself and then at the same time reinforce, no, but I'm Latin, with hence her marriage to Mark Anthony. I mean, I just feel like she is a con artist. I mean,
yeah.
she's, you know, and for most people, I think that she's winning. I mean, most people
yeah.
don't even know that kind of past, aren't even aware of the songs.
Even Kim Kardashian, I mean, it's how quickly Americans forget. I mean, their memory is very short. Even Kim Kardashian, who was much more of a black girl, or wannabe black girl when she first comes out. So again, she becomes famous because of a sex tape with Ray J, who is an urban artist, right? They have this really kind of grimy interaction that goes public. She's also becomes famous because she's accused of stealing money and clothes from Brandy. Because again, Kardashian becomes into fame because she is the stylist for Brandy Norwood, who's Ray J's big sister.
Oh.
And so that is how Ray J beats Kim Kardashian. Brandy sues Kim Kardashian. Brandy and her mother sue Kim Kardashian for stealing clothes and money from Brandy because Kim is Brandy's stylist. That's how she becomes famous. She meets Ray J, sleeps with Ray J, becomes even more famous, and now she's become America's sweetheart even. And not only is she famous, but now her mother and her, like, five sisters and her one brother are famous as well.
Who are also really invested in the...
In blackness. I mean, they've dated just about every black male athlete.
I know.
You know... And they've moved on to the rappers.
Yeah, and they've been, and what's so funny about them, Timberlake, Robin Thicke, John B., Kardashians, is how silent they've been in as of late when it comes to
Black Lives Matter
all
stuff.
Black Lives Matter. Yeah, and I've actually seen memes going around talking about these folks who, again, who sleep black, who get with black people, who are erotically attracted to African Americans, you know, and to the point where that seems to be the only folks they date
for,
and the only folks that they're with. Now, again, me and Jay are all for the interracial relationships, but there has to come... There has to come to, you know, a time where...
Where it doesn't look like an exoticism or kind of a fetishization.
You're sleeping with someone who's African-American every night, and you're watching the news and seeing Black Lives Matter, and your silence is deafening.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, what can we think?
Well, that's very true. Doc, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to share, listeners, with you all some excerpts from some past discussions we've had with mothers of black children. As we reflect on this 3-year anniversary of the Black Lives Matter movement, the Trayvon Martin case, and this 1-year anniversary of Sandra Bland's death. This is Strange Fruit on WFP. I will be right back. Are you hungry for more Strange Fruit?
I'm hungry.
Just can't wait for more.
Where else can you go in, get it done your way, and go out without paying?
Visit us online at strangefruitpod.org.
Like us on Facebook.
You like the adulation, the applause.
Or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
And this is what the gay life is about.
Thanks for listening.
Right?
I'm Acacia, and listen to Uncle Jason and his friend Kyla on Strange Fruit on WFPO.
Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit on WFPL.
So this week marks 3 years since George Zimmerman was found not guilty of the murder of Trayvon Martin there in Florida. And violence against black people by police continues to spark protests throughout the country. The day of the Zimmerman verdict, we spoke with attorney Lucy Brooks about what it's like to raise black sons in the U.S. We'll listen back to that conversation now, since it's so sadly just as relevant today.
Now, the jury was all white women.
Five white women.
And one woman, race unknown, probably Latino.
I love unknown.
Probably Latino. In Florida, probably a white Latino. So essentially six white women.
Yes. There were no black women or black men on
there. And to me, we know how important jury selection is and about how demographics matter, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you want women, you want men, you want black, you want white, you want poor.
Was there any outcome, like, was there any news about, like, jury selection and why there were no black women and no black men?
The defense certainly didn't want anybody. They felt like tried to strike anyone black because they felt like they couldn't be impartial.
That was very intentional.
What do you think? Yeah, especially as an attorney,
what do you, in terms of what the prosecution and defense were thinking as an attorney, in terms of jury selection, but then also as a parent, why didn't the fact they were mothers, why didn't that persuade them to see themselves as Trayvon's mother, perhaps?
Okay, well, we'll talk about two things. First, just from the legal side, I'm not a criminal law attorney, but a lot of my close friends and colleagues who I greatly respect are, and a lot of them are actually defense attorneys. I know some prosecutors, but not as many. And the jury selection, just first of all, was a huge, huge problem. B-37, when they were talking, there's a legal term for it, but, you know, everyone gets to talk to the jurors before and ask them questions to try to suss out what their biases might be. And when they were talking to her, those, as you all will remember, leading up to George Zimmerman's arrest, there were marches and protests, and there was a lot of online activism with Twitter and Facebook. And that juror referred to those as riots, right? She called those riots, which to me is a huge red flag. She was also very, very pro gun ownership, and she should have never been on the jury. Now, on the prosecution side, as I said, I know some prosecutors that I have great respect for, but we're not talking about individuals here. We're talking about a system. And when it comes to the system and prosecution, prosecution is not in the business of humanizing and defending young black men. No. They're not.
They're simply not. It's usually quite the opposite.
It's the other way around. And I truly think even if the prosecutor had good intentions and wanted desperately to win this and prosecute this, they're not in the business of knowing how to successfully handle this type of case. What's good for them usually was not good for them in this case. I mean, it's astounding what I do know about criminal law and what I've witnessed from friends that are public defenders. The police were not testifying for the prosecution. That almost never happens. Like, it is unheard of that the police are there with the defense against the prosecution. Prosecutors and police officers are like BFFs
so
usually.
So does that hint at a larger a conspiracy, if you will? I mean, so in other words, even in terms of just the mentality of folks in Sanford, Florida, the fact that the cops even tended to side with George Zimmerman, as opposed to what traditionally happens, like, is there a culture of simply, what do you make of that?
Well, conspiracy, I mean, there are certainly some people that feel like there's a out-and-out conspiracy here. They feel like the prosecutor never cared about getting a conviction. They feel like there was a literal conscious conspiracy. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
These days, it's really hard not to feel like that's the case. But what is perhaps more likely is actors in a system that perpetuates all of this that don't have the willingness to examine what they're doing, right? Yeah. So they perpetuate this, and they have these unconscious prejudices.
It's like the master's tools in the master's house. It's like the cops aren't going to undo the system that they're a part of, essentially.
No, yeah. And the prosecutor might even feel the same way. Now, to talk to, you know, my side as a mother, it is Dr. Story conveyed to me. Part of the reason I was asked to be here is because I have legal background. I'm also a white woman, like the jury,
yes.
And I'm a mother to two Black boys age 14 and about to turn 13 in less than a month, and then two biracial boys who identify as Black, one who is 5 and one who is 3.
Yeah.
And as the mothers, you know, do these mothers, how could they return a verdict that says it was okay and you did literally nothing wrong, nothing that you can spend even 1 year in jail for killing this boy? Because he was a boy. He wasn't a man. I think that's an important distinction to make.
Mm-hmm.
And as I know this because I am experiencing through my children racism they will experience. So, right, I'm a white woman out on the street. I have all these privileges, but they don't apply to my children, which is a huge area to lose privilege in, right? It's a really sucky one to lose privilege in. And these white women do, and every Black mother for hundreds of years knows this, do not see their children in the same way. And it starts from a really early age. I've been, like I said, I'm a writer, and on Twitter I'm connected with a large community of writers. And after the verdict, it seemed very off topic, but I started tweeting, this is why it matters what you write, right? Because we go to the bookstore when our children are little toddlers and we get them books to read them, and they're nothing but white children. Those kids get bigger, they go to the bookstore, get books to read, and it's nothing but white main characters. And the ways that we learn to empathize with people through stories and through media and through all these other things, Black children aren't there. There's no Trayvon Martin in young adult literature.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't exist. Yeah. And if he does show up, it's because he's probably trying to rob or rape the white girl who gets an excuse to use her superpowers.
Yeah, like that video game, Grand Theft Auto.
Grand Theft Auto, and like a popular urban fantasy young adult series I've read, there's not a Black male in the whole series. There's a Black woman and some gay characters, and the author cares about being inclusive. But I'm sure in a subconscious way, when she needed someone to show up and try to rape the girl so she could discover her new superpower, kind of like Sookie, you know, fireballs going at you type thing, she probably without even thinking about it stereotyped to a young Black man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because those stereotypes are really deeply ingrained. And the defense went with that. They in many ways went with the, well, wouldn't he have looked suspicious? He was intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
To where it became believable to people that a man with a gun that was much bigger and older than this boy could be not only scared but
deathly
repeatedly
afraid,
deathly afraid, could have his head beaten into the ground over and over and over again. And while we saw pictures of the back of his head, there was certainly some injury there. Taking 25 blows to the back of your head on the concrete would result in more than that.
Oh yeah,
it just would.
It's
which,
like brain damage.
Which gets us back to what version of the facts you choose to believe. And the defense spent a lot of time, without directly saying it, creating a very scary Black man as opposed to a young, scared
Black boy. Mm-hmm.
And the prosecution did not know how to humanize him.
Another one of our favorite guests is Representative-elect Attica Scott. Attica has joined us to talk about various topics over the years, and today we're listening back to our conversation about police violence in particular.
In your op-ed piece, Attica, you were talking about having to have the talk, and not the talk that we kind of understand of birds and bees, but having to have a talk
of
with
both
your children about how to interact with the police.
Yes, exactly. And to say to my son, when you go to work tonight, if you get stopped, I don't care if you didn't do anything wrong, you better muster up all the respect that you can. You know, I can't stand no ma'am, no sir, yes ma'am, yes sir, because it seems so antebellum to me, but you better figure out how you're going to say that, because I can't control what happens to you. My position and title will not save you. So you better figure it out. And it's not easy, because I also want to raise independent children who are willing to challenge the system. But then I'm in conflict because I want them to live.
That's something that you said, and I'm going to pull this up, that was very powerful. You ended... Do you remember what you know what I'm talking about?
The last line? I'm tired of paying y'all to kill our kids.
Say that again.
I'm tired of paying police officers to kill our children.
Expound upon that idea. Please.
That's exactly what we do. People need to understand that police officers are paid by taxpayer dollars. And we need to speak out. We need to be loud. We need to say, we're no longer going to stand for that. You don't get to go on administrative leave with pay and my baby's gone for no reason. That is not okay, folks. We have got to become much more educated about how the system works, so we can change the way it works.
And understand that officers work for us.
That's right.
As citizens, as United States citizens, the police work for us. They should not survey us in these kind of guard dog ways where you're like afraid, like making sure you made a complete stop and making sure this. I mean, you know, it creates a sort of anxiety. Anytime I see a police car and I'm driving, I have anxiety.
Well, I was going to say, my son, just this week we were driving and I had him driving the car. Yeah. I was riding with him. And a police officer was riding behind him, and he got so nervous. And that's when I knew that even though on Saturday when we talked, he tried to laugh it off because he didn't want me to be nervous for him. But the nervousness he felt, the anxiety when he felt when that police officer was just driving behind us. And then he starts talking to himself, okay, you know, what you going to pull me up? What you going to do? Yeah. I'm going to speed limit.
You got to talk yourself out of it. You do.
And I'm just watching him and realizing that he experienced, and if I wasn't in the car, I can only imagine how even heightened that anxiety is.
All right. So shout out to Lucy and to Attica for letting us revisit.
Lucy is a perfect example of what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Here Lucy is in a marriage to an African-American man, our friend Brooks. She has two black sons from Brooks' first marriage. She also has two biracial sons from her and Brooks' marriage together. And she is actively... directly, deliberately, always pointed out racism, unfairness, white privilege, all of those things, because her family is a black family.
Certainly.
You know? Yeah, so shout out to Lucy. How you doing, Lucy?
All right. Listeners, we're out of time. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Please continue to provide us with feedback on our Twitter and on our Facebook, or go to WFPO.org and send us feedback there. So until next time, say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everyone. Strange Fruit is produced by 89.3 WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Our producer is Laura Ellis.
For more information on Strange Fruit, go to strangefruitpod.org, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter at strangefruitpod.
The views presented on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters. I'm Jason Gardner.
And I'm Kyla Story.
Thanks for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Produced by Her, a screening of four documentaries that were made in the Produced by Her media program.